Welcome to Free Thoughts, a podcast project of the Cato Institute's libertarianism.org. Free Thoughts is a show about libertarianism and the ideas that influence it. I'm Aaron Powell, a research fellow here at Cato and editor of libertarianism.org.
And I'm Trevor Burrus, a research fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies.
Our topic for today's episode is the presidency. Joining us is our colleague Gene Healy, vice president of the Cato Institute and author of Cult of the Presidency and False Idol. Gene, as I was prepping for today's episode, I looked back at Article 2 of the Constitution, which describes the executive branch. And I was struck, as I always am when I look at it, at just how short it is. There's really not much to it. So I was wondering, could you maybe start by telling us what the Constitution says the president is supposed to be up to, and then maybe how we got to where we are today?
It's interesting. Some of the unitary executive advocates argue that the very brevity of Article II speaks to the vast powers that the president has.
And by unitary executive, you mean people who think that the executive is essentially a king almost, or
well,
at least imbued
at
with
one, at one extreme. I mean narrowly, without getting too far into this, narrowly stated, the proposition for unitary executive theory is that the president has the executive power, the whole thing, as Justice Alito put it once. And that doesn't require that you any particular interpretation of the executive power. It means at a minimum that you – if you're a unitary executive theorist, you think the president can fire his Secretary of State without going to the Senate for approval. It doesn't necessarily commit you to the view that because the president can fire his Secretary of State, he can therefore also wake up one morning and decide that we're going to war with Russia over the Crimea. Congress be damned. But at the extreme of that, a unitary executive theory in recent years has become associated, rightly or wrongly, with some advocates who take a much broader view of the executive power, particularly in the ever-expanding area of national security. But I think at its essence in Article 2, president does have the executive power, and the executive power is principally the power to execute the laws. It's not an accident that Article 1 contains most of the important powers Article 1 contains Congress's powers. It's also not an accident that Congress has more power formally, whether they choose to exercise it or not, over the executive than vice versa. Congress can remove the executive. It doesn't work the other way. Congress can the old law professor Charles Black used to say that he told his classes that Congress could defund the White House and reduce the president's staff to one secretary for answering correspondence. And he said his students thought he was joking, but Congress under its formal powers actually can do that. Most of the important powers in government are in Article 1, in the federal government are in Article 1, and they're given to Congress. And it's for that reason that actually not in his most prescient moment that Madison and others among the framers thought that in a Republican government, the legislative branch was the most to be feared. They were actually concerned at the convention, some of them, with providing the president with means for protection so that he would not necessarily get swallowed up in this vortex.
Interesting. So that seems to also tie in with the George Washington status too, possibly, which I think is always interesting when they're writing Article 2. They have George Washington in the room with them, and everyone in the room knows that he's going to be president first. So that seemed to probably influence maybe how they wrote the article and everything about the president's powers.
Yeah, I think Washington was viewed as someone who could be trusted with power, in part because the model of power he embodied was quite different than modern presidents. He's a man who the man who would not be king, in the famous phrase that he exhibited in the legend Cincinnatus-like virtues of self-denial of power. And I think that did go into how the executive was viewed.
But if we look at the next presidents, that we start immediately having these conversations about kings, even at the end of Washington's term, and then John Adams' term was constantly – he was constantly attacked for wanting to imbue the president with too much nobility and trying to take too much power. But it keeps growing and growing, and this conversation of how powerful the executive is going to be, you know, there are these kingmakers and these non-kingmakers. It's just sort of a motif we have from the very beginning.
Yeah, there's some debate among presidential scholars, political scientists who study the presidency around this concept of what they call the modern presidency, this presidency that's a plebiscitary figure that draws power from being viewed as the one legitimate representative of the whole people, a tribune of the people, a president with broad unilateral powers in foreign affairs and even domestic affairs. And the debate is there such a thing as a modern presidency? Because you can see at least the seeds of what we know and don't necessarily love in the modern presidency. In early presidents, you have Andrew Jackson making the claim that the president is the people's tribune in essence. You have James K. Polk showing that the separation of command of the army and the power to authorize war, that the president's command of the army could on occasion make Congress's power to declare war something of an afterthought simply by sending troops into disputed territory and providing occasion, making a war a fait accompli. And you know, of course, you have Lincoln who exercised executive powers during the Civil War that are at least as broad as virtually anything we've seen before or since. But after Lincoln, you do see a return or congressional resurgence and a return to a congressionally dominated government with fairly anonymous presidents. So I do think there is a transition in the 20th century largely inspired by progressive ideology that makes the presidency something quite different than it was through most of the early constitutional period and most of the 19th century.
Is this growth in presidential power during the 20th century a result of the president taking on more power himself, or is it more a result of Congress abdicating power to the presidency, or both? I mean, I guess I'm asking, is this – has the president as an office done this for and to himself, or has it been – has Congress been kind of leading the charge to offer up its power to someone else?
It's both. Arthur Schlesinger, who popularized the term the imperial presidency in his 1970-71 book, that name, he says that you know it was often a case of congressional abdication as it was of power-hungry presidents. And part of that I think is something that maybe inherent to the constitutional design, an unintended consequence, which is Madison and others among the framers thought that each branch – that ambition would counteract ambition and that each branch would have sufficient incentive to fight for its own territory, that the interests of the man would be aligned with the constitutional rights of the place. And particularly in the 20th century, you see sort of misaligned incentives because there's this phrase commonly, you know, you hear over and over again, that nobody wants to leave the presidency, you know, weaker than they found it, and they generally don't. Presidents have every incentive to fight for an expansion of their powers, whereas very few elections turn on the voters punishing congressmen for abdicating constitutional responsibility. I mean, you can. I think it probably hurt John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, and a few others in Democratic primaries in 2007, 2008 that they had delegated the power to launch a war in Iraq to George W. Bush. But in general, you know, most congressmen get reelected, and it's very rare that voters actually punish somebody for punting the question of war or and peace to a president. The incentive for individual congressmen, in fact, is often to duck that question, whereas the incentive for presidents is to harness, amass, and increase their power.
And so you've called this the cult of the presidency in your book, which sort of came out at a time when presidential power seemed to be most criticized almost, at least by the John Stewarts of the world. And then we get Barack Obama, which just continues that forward. But can you describe a little about what the term cult of the presidency means as you use it?
Well, it's an umbrella term. It's a sort of shorthand for how Americans view the office, this combination supreme warlord of the earth and national nanny. And one of the points of the book is the old Pogo principle. We've met the enemy and he is us. You can blame power-hungry presidents. You can blame feckless Congresses. But ultimately, I think the ordinary voter and particularly the intellectual elites bear a large share of responsibility, the lion's share of responsibility for what the presidency has become, because the ordinary voter and the pundits and scholars look to the presidency, look to the office of the presidency to achieve things it was never designed to achieve. They invest the office with a vast array of responsibilities. The president is responsible for teaching the children well, saving us from hurricanes, stopping oil spills in the Gulf, stopping school shootings, and even for if there's a general sense of malaise in the land, the president is somehow responsible for the tenor of the national spirit. And when you invest when you expect a person or an office to deliver on that kind of responsibility, one thing that's natural is that confronted with that vast job description, presidents are going to seek power to try to meet that. And I think that is one of the reasons that that dynamic is the fundamental reason why the office has drifted so far from the comparatively modest vision of the presidency that animated the framers.
Was it perhaps too much for the framers to hope for that we could have a president without an associated cult? I suppose in the sense that, I mean, you look back at the scope of human history is charismatic leaders and people flocking to them. So it's been kings and popes and various, I mean, just celebrity culture is
Vince Lombardi.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to find people who we then invest with great importance and then turn over, you know, they're the ones who are going to solve. I mean, monotheism is an instance of this as well. That this is just – there was no way we could have any amount of power focused in a single person, whereas Congress is hundreds of people. The Supreme Court is nine people. But you put a single person up there, we're just going to direct all of these hopes and dreams and aspirations at that person?
That may be the case. I'm reading and maybe the decision against a plural executive – at the Philadelphia Convention had a lot to do with this. I'm reading a very interesting book right now called The Once and Future King by Frank Buckley over at George Mason. And he makes the case for a parliamentary system, not that he recognizes we're not about to shift gears and adopt one, but by close study of Britain and Canada in particular in their constitutional history, he makes a fairly persuasive case that whatever our natural tendency to invest quasi-spiritual longings in a governmental figure, the specific form of the presidency and the separation of powers makes that tendency worse, that parliamentary systems by separating the roles of head and state and head of government sort of fights against this this tendency that, you know, no one in Britain you know, ever looked to Gordon Brown or David Cameron for the state of the national soul, and that you know, that they invested these longings for national identity on a fairly harmless monarch. So I think there's something to be said for that, and Buckley also draws it out with attention to presidential systems in general, which have been I think the political science on this is pretty clear at this point. Presidential systems controlling for everything else are particularly bad for developing countries. There's the scholar Juan Linz, who died last year, started making that case with the article in a book, The Perils of Presidentialism, that developing countries that adopt that had adopted an American-style system have far more unstable governments that they, in many cases, and are more likely to drift away from a democratic form of government than countries that adopt parliamentary regimes. And that we may enjoy the level of individual liberty and representative government that we have in spite of our presidential system and in part because of our great wealth and our Anglo-American traditions, but that the presidential system we've adopted is not something that seems to be helping.
Yeah, and I've made that point before too, that something to just sort of channel people's spiritual longings away from a guy who is megalomaniacal enough to want this job. Almost this weird thing that there's something about hereditary monarchy that's powerless, that it has something to commend it, I would say, which is a different question of the kind of people who want the job becomes the next question, because after you make more and more power goes to it and you believe that you control the national conscience, well, then it seems like you're choosing some of the worst megalomaniacal people to even want this job in the first place.
Yeah, supposedly Alan Greenspan said something in his memoirs from a couple years ago that something to the effect of I've only ever proposed one constitutional amendment and I'm quite serious about it, that anyone who wants the job should be forever barred from seeking office. I think he said that of all the presidents he knew, Gerald Ford, who kind of stumbled into it, was the one who seemed most well-adjusted and sane. The presidential selection system has changed quite a bit also over the 20th century in ways that have also had unintended consequences and consequences that I think make it increasingly less likely that a Cincinnatus-type self-denying figure will seek the office. You have a push toward the primary process, the relative decline of the importance of the smoke-filled room and political conventions, and public democratic contests for who becomes the major party standard bearer. And while I think the principles animating that shift were they seem fairly innocuous ones and even laudable ones, the effect is that more so than ever before, to become president, you have to announce at least 2 years before Iowa, and you are going to spend that time raising money, traveling throughout Iowa, New Hampshire, other places. Spending your time on the road and increasingly shielding any of your authentic opinions to the extent that you actually have them after a life in politics from any from public exposure. And whatever this process selects for, it doesn't really select for intelligent, public-spirited people who want to, for example, reduce the powers of the presidency. If you're going to run this gauntlet, if you are going to do what it takes to grab that ring, one of the last things I think you would – that system would select for is somebody who goes through that process, does what it takes and says, okay, now that I'm here, I think I should have a lot less power.
Yeah, and I think that also the cost it puts on your family is – that's the one that always gets me. Your kids will never be able to live like a normal life. They will not have a normal childhood. They will go to places with Secret Service all the time and you think that this is all worth it, so you might have a chance to direct the national – spirit so you can save America. That just is bizarre.
That's a good point. You know, it's one that, you know, at least our last two presidents had fairly young kids. You know, your first date is going to be with a Secret Service man in the background. You're going to see Jon Stewart make fun of your dad on TV, and you know, you have to worry about your father getting shot. It's not something I'd want to put my kids through, and I think it is pretty unusual. I do think increasingly the system selects for the kind of people
that you don't want
having nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
One of the things that's always struck me as interesting about that and about this notion that, you know, we get these people who we don't want is that given the two parties that we have in this country and the fact that we have a very partisan political system, everyone seems to agree with that about half the time. They always, you know, if I'm a Democrat and the Republican wins, then we've gotten someone we don't want and it's terrible if he's got all these powers, and if I'm a Republican and a Democrat wins, I feel the same way. But and then you couple that with the fact that presidents, even if my party's guy gets elected, I tend to be super enthusiastic when he's first elected, and then by the end of his second term, he's a bum. He's failed all the things that I hoped for. But we never seem to learn our lesson. We never say like, well, yeah, my guy might get elected, but the other guy might too, so I don't want to give him that much power. Or I've gotten burned by the last three members of my own party to achieve the office, but this next one, he's going to be the one.
That's the one. Just,
it seems very, very weird.
There's the myopia of not being able to think past the next election cycle. That was nicely illustrated in a 2012 video that I think it was Gawker put together, going around the Democratic National Convention and asking prominent Democratic figures, I think including Harry Reid. So do we think that Mitt Romney can be trusted with the governmental kill list and watching their – you know, it's like they'd never thought of that. So there is that, and there – yeah, it is perplexing that this perennial cycle of you know, exuberance and deep disappointment doesn't stop people from falling in love with the romance of the presidency every 4 to 8 years over again, depending on – you know, which side of the political aisle you're on. You'd think after a while people would be able to have a bit of a longer attention span and realize that this process is not ever going to guarantee anything other than perennial disappointment and the accumulation of state power.
And in your addendum to Cult of the Presidency or sequel or however we want to call it, False Idol, because we really saw that I think in Barack Obama in the level that at least in my lifetime I haven't seen and maybe in a long time, this absolute fervor for a man and then increasing disappointment.
Yeah, I was in law school in Denver when Obama was first running for president, and the convention, the Democratic convention, was in Denver, and the way that my law professors and many of my fellow students spoke about him, and they had their badges that would get them into the convention, and we all class got out early so everyone could go to this thing, and they'd hold it up, and there was just this kind of combination of you were going to witness, you know, something like your, you know, the return of the Beatles or something like that, plus the way that people talk about the Second Coming, or you know, that scene in the movie Independence Day when the people are on the roof of the building completely overcome with joy that the aliens are coming. Like, it was this just outpouring of optimistic emotions in a very unseemly
fashion. Yeah, I saw three people crying. Yeah.
And it was just – I mean, it was weird and off-putting.
So where are we now in that story?
Sure. Here in downtown D.C., Chinatown, where I was, it was like – you know, the Yanks had just liberated Paris. Where are we now in that cycle?
Yeah, in the cycle.
Well, we're in the far past the post honeymoon. You have schizophrenia on both sides of the aisle. So on the right, you have the presidency becomes such a focal point of all American hopes and dreams. You know, I say in the False Idol, the ebook, that when Obama said, "I'm like a Rorschach blot," he was more accurate than he knew, and especially having taken the presidency. You know, people see in this figure what they want to see. On the right, you have people who are. You were initially convinced that this was the second coming of, in a bad way, of LBJ and FDR. You have these theories that Obama, tutored by Saul Alinsky or Bill Ayers or whoever, has been engaged in a long-running plan, perfectly executed scheme to destroy the American way of life. And at the same time, and sometimes even in the same breath, you see otherwise intelligent figures on the right say that the man's total incompetent who took power when he barely knew where to find the stapler in the Senate office. And he's engaged in a decades-long conspiracy to destroy the American way of life, and he's really not doing a good job. So that's on the right. On the left, you went through this initial Beatlemania phase where everything was going to be terrific. The oceans rise would stop, and we'd find a cure for cancer in our time, and fundamentally transform the U.S. economy, and so on and so forth. To this. Really, the sense of disgust and betrayal in some quarters that the president is just not tough enough, ignoring the fact that for however much power the presidency has accumulated, there's still, particularly domestically, the president can't simply, like Captain Picard, just make a hand gesture and say "make it so" and fundamentally change American law and life.
And everyone who doesn't go along with him is obstructionist. He's supposed to lead the whole ship. So
it makes you wonder why anyone would want this job, because presidents tend to end up more or less they're perennial disappointments. And the only thing that's well, you can probably guarantee two things. The political scientist Theodore Loewy had one of Loewy's maxims, which was every president contributes to the upgrading of the reputation of his predecessors, and that's the only sure contribution that any president will make. So probably an idea reflected in that billboard a while ago in Texas with the big picture of George W. Bush that said, "Miss me yet?" Mm-hmm. People were going through everybody now looking back at H.W. and what a great president he was. And Clinton, who if you read the Wall Street Journal in the 1990s was running –
a socialist himself, right?
Yeah. And even in some of the things they ran, running a Murder Incorporated out of Arkansas, was a rapist and the worst crook ever. Now people look back on him fondly. So I think
I look back on him fondly.
Yeah. In retrospect, he seems a little bit like Warren G. Harding. He provided a lot of entertainment and there weren't really any great leaps forward in to speak of in government power during the Clinton years. The other thing that the presidency, in addition to what Lowy said, that you can reliably say about each successive president, for the most part, the office, they do leave the office stronger than they found it. And unless you think that the office of the presidency is perpetually too weak, that might not be a good thing.
So who are the great presidents then according to popular historic – I think we're talking about how political scientists view this and also how the public views this. Who are the ones that we look back on as great presidents? What typifies their administrations?
Well, there is what the scholars who participate in these – periodic presidential ranking surveys look at as the great presidents, and there I think you've got real evidence of perversity among intellectual elites. You have, if you look at the top 10 on, I think it's Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s father who did one of the first of these in the 40s, and we have them. Every few years or so, a bunch of different bodies that do them, the Siena Research Institute, sometimes magazines do them. Wall Street Journal did one 10 years ago trying to correct for liberal bias. And they're all pretty consistent. Even the Wall Street Journal one that tried to have a politically balanced panel of presidential scholars and law professors, they all come out mostly the same, and the top 10 presidents, you have a disproportionate number of war leaders, crusaders, people who tried to revolutionize the political order in some way. And the ones that do very badly are the ones that didn't do much and kind of bored people. And if you think the purpose of the presidency is to entertain presidential scholars, then that might mean something. But I think a perfect illustration of this is that on almost every presidential ranking survey, Woodrow Wilson is in the top 10 and his successor, Warren Harding, is last or next to last. And Wilson, probably the worst president in American history, took us into a destructive and an unnecessary war. Ran roughshod over civil liberties during the course of that war, was a horrible racist who resegregated the federal government. You could go on and on. Warren G. Harding dismantled much of the Wilson wartime economy, is too little recognized as a decent president on civil liberties. He pardoned and commuted sentences of Wilson's political prisoners, people like Eugene Debs, who had been put in jail for making under the Espionage Act for making a speech praising somebody who advocated draft resistance. And but Warren G. Harding, he had the Teapot Dome scandal, and that they hold that against him. But it doesn't seem to me that the Teapot Dome scandal killed 100,000 American doughboys. So maybe they should re-engineer their rankings. U.S. News a few years ago did an issue on America's 10 worst presidents, and William Henry Harrison made the bottom 10.
He was president for a month.
Yeah, he barely did anything but give the longest inaugural address in presidential history and keel over. So he didn't have any opportunity to do anything bad. What you see over and over again is that there is no respect for any kind of presidential Hippocratic oath, any concept that first do no harm might be the way to go. And you behind it all, you do see quite a bit of contempt for the idea of peace and prosperity. For in Harding's case, a lot of people sneer at his neologism normalcy, which just stood for getting back to a period of non-emergency, non-crisis government where you can go on and live your life and not be enlisted in grand national crusades. Well, if you look at the presidential rankings, that's an idea that a lot of scholars hold in deep contempt.
Wondering if you could talk a bit about what this all seems related to, which is kind of the culture of power worship that, I mean, is particularly prevalent in this town, in Washington, where there's almost a sense that the powerful are better than the rest of us simply because of their power or ought to be respected, and that respecting the powerful is part of being a good and fulfilled person. I'm thinking this week the New York Times columnist David Brooks penned a column, and he's penned a lot of columns of this sort.
Gene's already laughing just at the very mention of his name.
where he talked about the importance of basically freedom in subservience, that living under the powerful and doing what they want is an important part of living a good life. And this seems – I mean, this seems obviously very bound up in what we've been talking about.
Yeah, it's a perennial theme of David Brooks is that he's distrustful of I remember he wrote one a few weeks ago about millennials and their individualistic attitudes because I'm paraphrasing here, but it's close. So they're like, you know, a nation like this is not so easily led, which you would think would not be a bad thing. I think you do see some of that. That's reflected in the presidential rankings. That the notion that. And it's certainly David Brooks's work is a lot like that. The book on the bourgeois bohemians. It's a really amusing work of what he calls comic sociology. But there is also a note of there's something gross about people who want sleigh shower stalls and eat arugula and. Enjoy the simple or not so simple pleasures of life. You saw this after September 11th on left and right. There was a notion that we're going to have war and the moral equivalent of war. There are people that seem to think the worst thing that George W. Bush ever said after 9/11 was that. Not that we would rid the world of evil, but that we, people, what Americans should do is, relax, go enjoy America's great destination spots, or go to Disney World. That was a statement of Bush's that was attacked by John McCain, was attacked by Barack Obama, Joe Biden, you name it. There's this deep background notion that peace and prosperity. Living your life and determining your own purposes rather than being led in a what McCain calls a cause greater than yourself, that's just contemptible. We can't decide our own purposes in life. We need a grand government crusade to unite us all. And the grandest government crusade of all is war. And I think the growth of presidential power has very much been wrapped up in war.
I think I pulled a quote from False Idol from Chris Matthews, one of the most sycophantic people I know. This day he was inaugurated with the mall filled with people, African Americans and everyone else. Obama just sent us all home. Why are we in this fight with him? Just tell us, Commander. Give us our orders and tell us where we're going. Give us a mission. Yeah, I think that pretty much symbolizes that perfectly.
Yeah, this I say in the book that for some reason a lot of this tends to happen on Chris Matthews' show Hardball. You had Evan Thomas from Newsweek saying, Obama is floating above all of us. He's going to unite us all. He's sort of God.
I didn't know that. He actually said that.
Yeah.
This seems to be a big problem for – us as libertarians, right? Because I mean, no matter how good the policy proposals that we make are, and no matter how much we can show that you know, reducing the size of this program would lead to better results, or increasing choice, or, you know, expanding the reach of the market and shrinking the reach of politics would be good. At a very basic level, our view of good governance and good citizenship is 180 degrees from this, is that there's – that we shouldn't be ruled, and that we shouldn't be told what to do, or at the very least, if we're going to be told what to do by people, we shouldn't be told what to do by people who can use guns to back it up. If we want to listen to a charismatic leader, that's fine, but it ought to be voluntary. And so is this just – I mean, this just seems like a fundamentally different way of viewing the world.
Yeah, I think this is similar to something we've talked about, Aaron and I have talked about for years. We don't offer any great projects for people to go behind, and we don't talk in this rhetoric. And something Aaron and I talked about for years is the West Wing is an example of this show where the guy is always doing this.
Right. I've argued before that the West Wing, which I quite enjoy as a TV show, I think you and I disagree on that, but I enjoyed it, would have been – I mean, it needed to have a
mythical
leftist president, or I mean, or a statist president, so to speak, because if it had had a strictly libertarian president, it would have been an awfully boring show. Every episode, someone would have wandered into his office, said, "Here's a problem," and he would have said, "Nothing I can do about that.
What do you want from me?"
Yeah,
right. There isn't anything in the libertarian program that you know, you're sort of left with a. The rallying cry is "Get on with your life!" You know, that's go forth and prosper.
Leave me alone. Live your own life together.
I think, you know, perhaps that is a fundamental aspect of human nature that you know, libertarianism doesn't quite have an answer for. You know, it does seem to be worse among the intellectuals and what David Brooks calls, non-ironically, I think, the thought leaders. Because if you do look at the public is actually somewhat better on this, because if you look at polling data on various presidents, you know, Truman left office deeply unpopular. A lot of presidents invariably disappoint. But not all of them leave office totally unpopular. Reagan left office with above 50% approval ratings, as did Clinton. Warren Harding was wildly popular while he was around. So while presidents are in office, it's not as though there's a giant groundswell of people out there that it's like the old adage about neoconservatives being you know, a head with no body. You know, occasionally you can stir up war fever, but in general, if you want to be a successful president in the terms of, you know, being popular while you're in office, you do better not making a whole lot of trouble. But these presidents, you know, like Truman, who were wildly – and Wilson, who were wildly unpopular while their grand crusades and failed wars were going on, they tend to get upgraded by historians and in popular memory because we remember that they did something. So you know, I don't know if I have an answer to that fundamental problem. I would just say that whatever this longing is in human nature, it seems to be more vocally expressed among the people, the scholars who fill out presidential report cards and the pundits who follow the White House than it does among ordinary people.
It also might be the case that if you are an intellectual type and you think the rest of the people are benighted in some way and stupid, it's stupider than you are at least, that you think that's just what people need to pull them out of the darkness is someone to lead them to glory in some way.
Yeah, and some of it is ordinary boredom, I think. I quote Fred Barnes from the Weekly Standard after 9/11 in The Cult of the Presidency, where he wrote a piece early on talking about it. I was just so boring in the 90s. You know, nothing was going on. We didn't have we didn't have anyone leading us. We didn't have any wars to fight. And he
Soviet
looks,
Union was gone.
What yeah, you know? Yeah. So we got nobody to fight. And he looks back to, when he got to Washington during the first Gulf War and how awesome it was and how cool it was to have this to cover. Well, that's a kind of perverse and disgusting attitude, but I think it's more prevalent than not. I mean, war is a hell of a lot more interesting than the tax code.
Yeah, and you get the same thing in World War I buildup, which is of course the most almost apotheosis of the state leading people to destruction. But so many people sitting around being like, it's been so long since we've had a good European war. It's been at least since the Napoleonic Wars. It's about time. You've got to join the military, especially for the second born son, and somehow achieve glory. And the only way you can do that is on a battlefield. Everyone's itching for war. Even, 1910, they're just waiting for what's going to set it off, which is, again, incredibly perverse.
Yeah, it's the animating principle of national greatness conservatism. Like Teddy Roosevelt put it, war is a great tonic for the national spirit, and we need these unifying crusades to pull us out of our shabby little lives. How you defeat that notion is that's a tough question.
Why does it have to be invested in politics? I mean, why can't we have national greatness through technological accomplishments, through we as a people are going to eradicate hunger via entrepreneurship and expanding knowledge. I mean, there are all of these projects. They're all they're amazing things that have happened over the course of the last 100 years that have dramatically improved the quality of our lives. But we rally around the things that result in dead bodies. But it doesn't seem like it has to be that way. Just like it doesn't have to be – it wouldn't have to be the president that we rally around. We could rally around all sorts of different figures. Why do we invest it in the political?
Well, I suppose because it doesn't require anything of us. I mean, we could have rallied around Steve Jobs, but you sort of would have he didn't really need your help other than to sell your product. So a lot of what people in favor of this impulse would say is it doesn't celebrating human achievement that's accomplished through the actions of individuals, inventors, and entrepreneurs doesn't really require anything of us. I think it'd be a better country if, like some other countries, instead of having our presidents on our currency, we had people who accomplished
Thomas
something.
Edison, yeah.
Yeah, people who brought us light. Other than cheering your sports team, which is a far healthier thing than cheering your political party, the libertarians don't have any political way to tap into this impulse.
I think one of them would be free riding sense of accomplishment. That has to be something that's psychologically gratifying, right? So we could say we need to do things together, which when someone says that who's not Barack Obama, I say, yes, we do. Apple was not done just by Steve Jobs. It was done with a bunch of other people. But also that means that a bunch of other people can't free ride off of Apple's success, right? They can't feel a sense of accomplishment by having participated in something because they didn't actually participate in it, maybe by buying an Apple product. But people can really get shareholders. Yeah, it's pretty inclusive. It doesn't have a bunch of free riders. But when you start talking about national greatness and people who get like a sense of pride of being an American, they're free riding. If they haven't done anything that great, they're free riding off of the sense of community that other people achieved.
The interesting thing is modern war doesn't really require much more of us than it's not a – so you have a lot of bloggers who seem to think they were combat blogging by attacking peaceniks on the internet. But modern war does not with a volunteer military does not really require you to do much more than pay your taxes. So it's odd that you know, this collectivist impulse is, you know, is viewed as somehow satisfied when we're, it's not like we're going to war on terror bond rallies and saving scrap metal. But
yeah. So where do we go from here? Where do you see this going? Is there a solution to this process?
Or is it just going to get worse?
I don't think it's going to get worse. I mean, one of the things that the part of the cult of the presidency that people liked the least was the last chapter when I said, I thought pretty forthrightly that, look, I can give you a 5-point plan about how to save this, and you know, I'll go through the motions, but it's not going to work. That was the least popular part of the book because having proposed the problem, I didn't give anybody any solutions.
Because they want to be inspired and led.
Well, the solutions are hard, and you know, most of them run up against the fundamental problem. So, you know, you could propose strengthening the war powers resolution, but you've got the problem that. You know, the war powers resolution, which has been almost entirely useless and perhaps even pernicious, you know, was only passed in a unique historic window of opportunity with an embattled President Nixon where you could actually override a presidential veto. And it's gone on. It hasn't really constrained presidents at all. Obama became the second president to wage a war beyond the 60-day limits. The first was President Clinton, but many presidents have used it, in fact, to argue that the resolution authorizes short, sharp uses of force, which by its plain terms it doesn't. But they use the 60-day limit to say that, well, you know, you said we could use it. You could just wage war for up to 60 days with a free pass. Most statutory restrictions are for reasons like that, are unequal to the task. We're not going to transmute into a parlamentary government, and that would not solve most of our problems, I don't think. So it's not something that – and I continue to hold out hope that, for example, the Obama presidency would heighten the contradictions, that you would have somebody who pumped up expectations for what the presidency could achieve even far beyond what the irrational heights they'd reached before and then failed spectacularly. You'd think that would maybe condition people to invest less, invest fewer hopes in the presidency. You know, I'm not sure that's going to happen either. There are long-term trends, though. I mean, it's very easy for us, particularly as libertarians, I think, to say things are always getting worse. But a longer-term view, I think there are some secular trends that are encouraging, at least. One of my points is the decline in trust in government. This is something that when the trust in government numbers come out, that they're in this town, it's usually recognized as a crisis. People don't trust government as much as they used to. And you know, this is one of the longest running polling questions. It dates to the second Eisenhower administration. How much of the time do you trust the government in Washington to do what is right? Most of the time, always, just about never. They usually combine the most of the time and just about always answers, and that gives you the trust in government index. And when they started taking it in the late Eisenhower, early New Frontier era, you had over 75% of Americans saying that they trusted the federal government in Washington to do what is right most of the time or just about always. It was reflected in the popular culture. It was reflected in the culture of journalism. Investigative journalism did not really exist to the extent that it does today. And you know, someone ridiculing the president like John Stewart would probably be arrested like Lenny Bruce in the early 60s, or at least would not have a popular platform. And after They start going down in – the numbers start plummeting when the Vietnam War starts going badly in 66 or thereabouts. They never recover after Watergate. They bottom out during the 70s. They spike a little bit after 9/11 but quickly go back to Watergate-era levels. Now, declining public trust isn't always a good thing. It's not good when you see the numbers say interpersonal trust between Americans is going down and you know, there's some relationship between the two. But you know, scholars who study trust in the trust in government number have correlated it with fewer wars, less tolerance for military adventurism, and even from the domestic side for libertarianism. There's a scholar named Mark Hetherington who's showed that you know, it really means that a new deal and a new great society is no longer possible. It's a conclusion that he didn't like being a liberal Democrat, but he says this is pretty much, you know, Obamacare barely squeaked to the Heritage Healthcare Foundation, the Heritage Healthcare plan basically barely got passed. You're not going to see, he says, a new deal, a new great society, because the public doesn't trust the federal government enough to allow that. So that's a trend that I think constrains presidents somewhat. In some ways, given the shock of 9/11 and those horrific images, it's a little bit astounding that we did not see worse abuses than we did. You know, we shouldn't be happy about the ones we did see, but you could foresee it in an atmosphere of more trust going even worse. So I take some, you know, I have a grain, I take a grain of optimism from that trend. I think that if you look at the reverence with which presidents were treated before Watergate, there's a passage from the – there's a selection of the Watergate tapes where Haldeman and Nixon are talking about you know, should we squelch the Pentagon Papers? Should we prove – should we try to keep the Washington Post and the New York Times from releasing this? And Haldeman says to Nixon, you know, this is a very bad thing if this gets out. It, you know, it means that the implicit infallibility of presidents, which is an accepted thing in America, you know, will no longer be taken for granted. And you know, I say in the book that you, no one today would talk about the implicit infallibility of presidents. Nobody believes that, and it's a ludicrous idea. But it was something that you could talk about as recently as, you know, 1972. That was a widely accepted thing in America, you know, where there's no putting that genie back in the bottle, and that's a good thing. So I think another trend will be the relative decline of American military power, that we will not be – we're in no danger of not being the dominant military power on the globe for our lifetimes. But I think international – changes are going to force the United States to behave a little bit more like a normal country in international affairs. And since the growth of the imperial presidency coincides with America's rise to world dominance, I think that's going to be a good thing, and I think it will restrain further growth of presidential powers somewhat. But you know, as for returning to something like the modest presidency of the Harding and Coolidge years, that does not seem to be in the cards anytime soon.
Thank you for listening to Free Thoughts. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, you can find us on Twitter at Free Thoughts Pod. That's Free Thoughts, P-O-D. Free Thoughts is a project of Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute and is produced by Evan Banks. To learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.